Yeah, so thank you everyone for coming. So I'm going to be talking about a project I've been working on for a while with Jess Riedel here at Perimeter also. Yeah, this has been in the works for a while, and it's basically done. We're going to post a paper next month, so I'm excited about that. So there are a few related papers here. One is the first one, which is a paper of mine on decoherence during inflation from gravitational interactions, and this is closely related to this project. And then the second paper is a paper by Jess on branching of a wave function in just a general sort of quantum information context. And so that's kind of the backdrop for this project being a specific system in which we look at that structure. So if you're interested in more, you can check out those papers. So briefly, the outline of the talk is I will give some general motivation for studying the emergence of classicality in general from some unitarily evolving quantum state, and then in particular in cosmology. I will study the wave function of cosmological fluctuations during inflation, and then after inflation in a decelerated epoch, and look at classical aspects in each of those cases. Okay, so the ultimate goal that this talk is sort of situated in the context of, I'm not going to try to solve this really big problem, but this is the general context. So this is sort of a measurement problem. We would like to understand, given some quantum state, it's evolving unitarily in time, we would like to understand how measurements happen, mathematical description of measurements as physical processes. So what do I mean by this? So by measurements, I don't mean just things that happen in a lab. I just mean any randomness or stochasticity from quantum mechanics and the corresponding classical behavior. In particular, I don't want to have to sort of postulate that there's a system and an environment and these degrees of freedom are acting as the environment and they're decohering these degrees of freedom, or that there's this particular measurement basis in which collapse happens. I don't want to have to put in those extra ingredients. I want to be able to look at the evolving global wave function and ask, can you derive, how does that structure emerge? So that's sort of the overall philosophy. And so how would we do that? So given some Hamiltonian or something that's describing how the degrees of freedom are organized, what constitute different subsystems and how they are entangled and how that entanglement is changing over time, we have some way of talking about where measurements could come from or where stochastic behavior could come from. So this is sort of the general philosophy behind this.
So where did your Hamiltonian come from?
In this talk, I would just use some Hamiltonian for cosmological fluctuations, but in general, we kind of assume that there just is a Hamiltonian, and in particular, we'll assume it's a local Hamiltonian, so we can talk about, we have a preferred notion of local subsystems. In terms of where does a Hamiltonian come from in a more fundamental way, I'm not sure. We assume that there is a Hamiltonian.
So you're also assuming a space-time?
In this talk, I will assume some space-time. So I'm not going to try to solve quantum gravity or derive classicality out of some really generic Hilbert space.
Is the Hamiltonian in mini-superspace?
So the Hamiltonian is just going to be the Hamiltonian of a massless field in some FRW space-time.
So it's mini-superspace?
So.
It's not the full space-time. Both time and space, only time. Degrees of freedom.
The degrees of freedom are just a quantum field on space time.
Then it's not just cosmology. It's a...
The Hamiltonian, degrees of freedom in the Hamiltonian are not degrees of freedom of space time. You just have a classical FRW space time. I can basically what I'm going to say, you can also think about as being just some time-dependent Hamiltonian in flat space. It's not essential to think about it in terms of an expanding space, although that is helpful, I think. Okay, so the key aspect of measurement that this talk is going to be based on is redundant information. So we think this is an aspect of measurement or randomness from quantum mechanics whenever it happens. So a simple example of this is consider some quantum state, which is a particle in a superposition of being on the left and being on the right, and there's some laboratory and there's some environment, and these start in a product state. So then after time, measurement means that the particle gets entangled with the degrees of freedom in the laboratory in such a way that the conditional states of the lab are orthogonal, which means that the lab has just acquired information about where the particle is, so it's picohere the particle. But more generally, whenever a measurement happens, this process of entanglement continues, and you know, the lab is going to get entangled with the rest of the environment. And it's going to be the case that I can look at many different subsectors of the environment indexed by I here, and this can be like, you know, spatial regions or like the measuring device or the observer who's carrying out the measurement and so on. And each of them will have the information of whether the particle is on the left or the right. So there's just redundant information. So the fact that there are many redundant records of the decoherent degrees of freedom, in this case the position of the particle, this is what I'm taking as sort of at least a necessary ingredient of measurements, this amplification of information from the system into, you know, a very large number of subsystems of the environment. So this is probably not the only thing that one could be interested in with measurement. It's likely one would also be interested in some notion of irreversibility, that I can't just, once the information leaks out about where the particle is, I can't easily do some change in the dynamics that brings that information back and sort of conceals it again. But in this talk, I'm just going to mainly talk about redundancy as the key aspect of measurement. This is not something that only happens in laboratories. Again, just to sort of build intuition, we can think about some macroscopic classical object, like a rock. And let's say this rock is in some dark environment. It's not really interacting with anything. After a short passage of time, it will interact with a large number of photons in such a way that if I go around and look at different parts of the photon field in its environment, I can gain the same redundant information about this classical object. So that's why you can see it, basically. So in general, classical variables are going to be redundantly recorded. So this is just meant to continue to build intuition for thinking about measurement. And in particular, if we're talking about wave function branches, which I first introduced here, as being just the two terms in the global wave function on which the particle is either in the left or the right, and it's correspondingly redundantly recorded as being on the left or on the right. So in general, when some measurement or amplification event occurs in this generalized sense, the wave function is going to branch into different terms on which different outcomes occur, and as more amplification events or measurement events occur, this branching continues. And the property of these branches that I'm going to be interested in this talk is local orthogonality, which is, again, just this idea that I can look at many different spatial subsystems, which are basically the environment for a given classical variable, A or B or C or D, and they're all going to contain the same redundant information. And what this means is that the branches into which I decompose the wave function are locally orthogonal in each of these subsystems. This is something that Jess has worked a lot on, and you can look at this paper if you're interested in more. So the ultimate goal then, which I stated on the first slide, we can rephrase as being given a quantum state, again with some Hamiltonian, some which motivates some decomposition of the Hilbert space into subsystems, we have some unitarily evolving Hamiltonian, what are the branches of this wave function? Or equivalently, which variables emerge as being the preferred classical variables, which would be indexed collectively by this index I, and so on different branches, these classical variables have different stochastic outcomes. So in terms of criteria for branches, I at least want to require that there be this redundancy of information about the classical degrees of freedom, and I'll probably want to require something else at the end of the day. And just in passing, there's also this question of the uniqueness of the decomposition into branches. What do I need to require in order that there's a single decomposition that corresponds to our intuition for measurements? So I'm not going to address this question of uniqueness, but that's an important question. Yeah. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on the specific question of can we dynamically generate classical branches from some simple symmetric initial state for a field theory. So we just want to construct a model, basically, to understand how this can happen, to just construct a model that's tractable so that we can look at the wave function and see this process happening. So again, we're going to be looking for records in many local subsystems. So in principle, I could talk about various different kinds of subsystems, maybe subsystems in momentum space or phase space or something else, but we're going to assume that we have a local Hamiltonian, and so we have a preferred notion of subsystems as being local subsystems. So again, for a field theory, we are going to be interested in branching into classical fields. So the process that we're going to look for is some simple initial wave function, and this is just going to be essentially the ground state of a massless field. Then there's going to be some unitary evolution, and when we did this calculation, we did this in the Schrodinger picture using the functional Schrodinger equation to evolve the wave function in time. So that's not essential. You could also just look at correlation functions in the Heisenberg picture and find this information, but we found it instructive to do it this way. So the state that we then want to end up with is something like this, where on a given branch, the long wavelength degrees of freedom, the infrared, so they're in red, degrees of freedom of the field are in some eigenstates of the classical field. They're peaked around some classical field configuration. And then the remaining microscopic degrees of freedom of the field, which is the long wavelength parts are tensored together with here, are going to have the property that if I look at many different subsystems, I can see the same long wavelength information recorded in the microscopic parts. So we're just going to construct a model where these kind of dynamics happen. Okay, so this is the cosmology seminar. Hopefully you're not getting, if you're a cosmology person, bored with non-cosmology stuff. In the context of cosmology, basically the backdrop that I have in mind is that there's some global wave function of the universe, and branching occurs, and we end up with a particular realization of primordial fluctuations, which leads to a particular realization of the CMB, and so we just observe one branch of the wave function, and we're trying to understand how branching happens in the very early universe. But more generally, why would we care about cosmology for this general quantum mechanics problem? So here are some reasons why cosmology is interesting. So first of all, there are no observers, no measuring devices, no external environments in the early universe. I just have some quantum state. It's evolving in time. So I can't really get away with saying, well, there's just some external environment, it's decohering the field, and so I can treat it as classical. I really am confronted with the problem of getting this out of the structure of the wave function. In some ways, I have a realistic system, just because I have, yes?
Sorry, I just need to understand this branching thing that you're doing. It's not the average interpretation, is it?
I mean, I can think of it that way, but... Yes, so you can think about these as being the average branches of the wave function. Although I don't need to necessarily bring in all the baggage of that interpretation, but I can think of it that way.
So then you have to have a reason why the branching occurs, although, I mean, at every stage or every step in time, there's some sort of, how do you model that?
So we take as the reason why, or the indication that branching has occurred to be the fact that there's redundantly distributed information, and or at least that's a necessary component of branching. And I mean, that's what I'm going to talk about in this talk. Maybe you want to require more to say that, you know, the wave function is branched because of this measurement event. So I'm taking redundant information to be the necessary ingredient that I'm interested in. I'm not sure if...
Maybe I'll ask.
Okay, yeah, sure.
I suppose you could say that there may be many branches, but we are the observers in one of those branches.
Yeah.
So it is because of observers.
What do you mean it's because of observers?
We are in a particular branch.
Yeah, we're
so you're choosing a branch by observing.
But we don't need to say that it branched because we observed it. It could have branched long ago.
Yeah, I mean, you're not discussing that aspect, but we happen to be in one of those branches.
Right.
And that's why you're choosing that.
So. Yeah, that's true.
But so for the moment, you just look at the wave function and write it in this branch-structured way without actually changing it in any way.
Yeah, we don't change it. We don't add anything to quantum mechanics. We just want to look at the wave function.
And is it a good time model for what you're saying, that we would have branching if you had the dual wave function for the whole quantum field? Is a superposition of two classical configurations that are locally distinguishable everywhere?
Yeah.
Is that the time model we should be thinking?
Yeah. So it's basically going to be branching into classical configurations that are distinguishable by looking at many different. I can see that some given part of, say I have two classical configurations that are like exactly the same except for some small difference. That difference is going to be recorded in many different spatial locations.
So spatial locations meaning
regions of space.
Short distance.
Well, in the short wavelength, degrees of freedom, but maybe in some larger region of space, but some like many different finite regions. Okay, so I'm working with relativistic field theory. So this is realistic in the sense that it's better than working with a toy model of qubits or some discrete spin chain. So in that sense, it's a step more realistic. And I'm going to talk about gravitational interactions. Again, we don't need to think of this as being something about quantum gravity. I don't need to, the structure of the wave function that I'm going to talk about doesn't depend on these interactions being gravitational, but it's interesting to think about the role of gravity in this context. So we're going to use gravitational interactions. The state and dynamics are translation and rotation invariants. The initial state is the vacuum state. So I really get to start with this simple initial state, this idealized state, as a starting point and evolve from there. In the context of inflation, there's been a lot of work on quantum to classical dynamics related to decoherence and squeezing of the quantum state, which I'll mention. And basically what I'm going to say is that inflation through the squeezing of the state prepares a wave function that's very susceptible to the formation of redundant records and branching, and that in general this is a consequence of acceleration. So it's likely the case that in alternatives to inflation, you have this same kind of thing happening. The model that I'm going to talk about is tractable because the interactions are perturbative, and yet it's still the case that the interactions in a sense will generate a large effect because they'll be generating a large number of branches.
The vacuum you prepared minus infinity, like adiabatic vacuum, or?
Yeah, it's just the Bunch Davies vacuum. Yep. And lastly, cosmology is certainly interesting in its own right because primordial branching of a wave function in the early universe is going to be the origin of any subsequent randomness. So it's definitely an interesting system in its own right. So just to advertise what the state is going to, the wave function is going to look like, the wave function is initially going to be in this product state. So the branching is going to basically result from coupling of long and short wavelength degrees of freedom. So initially I'm going to start with the field being in the vacuum state where these degrees of freedom are unentangled. So schematically I have some short wavelength modes, some medium wavelength modes, and some long wavelength modes of the field. And then after a period of inflation and deceleration, degrees of freedom at different scales are going to get entangled. So short wavelength degrees of freedom are going to acquire information about the medium wavelength components of the classical field. And then eventually those medium wavelength degrees of freedom are going to acquire information about the long wavelength parts of the field. So this is just schematically the structure of the wave function that comes out of these dynamics. And I'll come back to this at a later point. So the model that we use is the following. I just have some massless scalar field an expanding space or with some particular time dependence. And then I have some interactions, and these interactions are motivated because they're the leading gravitational self-interactions of the metric scalar and tensor perturbations during inflation. So that's why I choose these interactions. A couple minor points here is that it's easiest to work in conformal time, and then these expressions phi, the field phi is rescaled to have a unit variance, so things are a little bit simplified in that way. G and G tilde here are just some small interactions. During inflation, they'll be related to slow roll parameters. The background cosmology, again, is inflation, and then after a finite amount of inflation, they just switch the scale factor over to being in the radiation era. So this is the model. So briefly, just to review what happens to the fluctuations quantum mechanically during inflation. So a given Fourier mode of the field starts on very short scales compared to the Hubble scale. And here this green line, so we're looking at co-moving wavelength versus time during inflation. This green line is the co-moving Hubble scale. So this is some fixed physical distance. It's decreasing in co-moving space, and so a given Fourier mode of the field is eventually just going to redshift past this scale, and its wavelength will be much longer than the Hubble scale. So in the sub-Hubble regime, the fluctuations are essentially just a free field in its ground state in the Minkowski space. So in phase space, they're just harmonic oscillators that I can represent like this. And then after they cross the horizon, these modes become highly squeezed, and as they continue to evolve, they become increasingly squeezed. So in phase space, they're going to look something like this. The spread in the conjugate momentum direction increases, but at the same time, the field is freezing out, and so the physical velocity, or the spread and the physical velocity just goes to zero. So briefly, squeezing and classicality. In this talk, I'm basically defining classicality in terms of branches of the wave function, but just to connect with other notions of classicality which are related. There's a sense in which the wave function becomes classical through this squeezing. So first of all, in the superhorizon regime, when the modes freeze out, the two-point function just goes to a constant. The wave function goes into this form where there's just some constant magnitude which corresponds to the modes having frozen out, and then there's some rapidly oscillating phase. And the fact that this phase is growing and is oscillating rapidly is basically equivalent to the fact that the state is becoming squeezed. When the amplitude of this phase is basically the amount of squeezing. So in phase space, this diagram here, again, I can just represent the wave function as being some classical distribution psi squared times a delta function, which basically just sets the conjugate momentum equal to some classical value corresponding to whatever the field amplitude is. So, in other words, what I have is basically just a probability distribution over classical trajectories. So for each sort of point along this line, I have a classical trajectory of the field oscillating, and then it crosses the horizon and freezes out. In this regime where it's freezing out, the wave function is just behaving as this classical probability distribution. So what I'm going to say is that this sense of classicality is a precondition for classicality in the sense of branching of the wave function.
That's a good question. Can you relate the degree of squeezing to how good of a representation the Wigner function is? So you're saying that a lot of squeezing equals classical, and classical equals I can describe things by this Wigner function.
Well, you can describe things by the Wigner
function
in any case.
Well, not really, because you can't really. I mean, things don't commute in quantum mechanics. So there's something about the commutation and relation not mattering anymore as kind of a necessary condition for describing things by this Wigner function.
So in the limit where things become really, really squeezed, then the non-commutation goes to zero. I can only describe things as a probability distribution in this sense, in that limit, but I can still use the Wigner function to talk about the wave function in phase space at other times. Okay, so now let's turn on the interactions. So again, the interactions that I'm using are these leading gravitational interactions, and of course, these interactions couple all modes of the field, but in particular, I'm just going to focus for now on the fact that they couple long and short wavelength modes. So consider a constant background in some region. I've highlighted in red here one of the factors of these cubic terms. So you can see that the effect of just turning on a constant background field is just to shift the gradient term or the kinetic term of the fluctuations in that region. So this just shifts the local background parameters. And the simplest example of this is slow roll inflation. So with inflation, I expect that a shift in the background field is going to shift me up or down the inflationary potential. And so I expect that it's just going to act as some shift in the local value of the Hubble constant set by the value of the potential. And you can check that indeed for the gravitational interactions in slow roll inflation, this is indeed what you get, that the value of these coupling constants acts in this way to shift the local Hubble rate. So now, quantum mechanically, I have been talking about the squeezing of the state. So what happens to a mode that has crossed the horizon and gone into a squeeze state in the presence of a long wavelength background? So as I just said, the long wavelength background just acts to change the local parameters. So what happens when I change the local parameters of this really squeeze state? Well, either I can stretch it a little bit more, or I can tilt its orientation in phase space. And so you can check that in this talk, I'm basically just going to focus on this particular interaction here. In the presence of this cubic interaction with a long wavelength field, basically, if I turn on a long wavelength field, the squeeze state is shifted to a completely orthogonal state once it gets squeezed enough. So in particular, once the amount of squeezing, or the ratio of the wavelength to the horizon scale gets small enough, then it can resolve a typical long wavelength fluctuation. So it's in this sense that the mode acquires a record of the long wavelength background, and as it continues to get more squeezed, the precision of this record gets higher, so that the precision with which it resolves the long wavelength fluctuation goes to zero. So this takes some time to happen during inflation. The mode has to evolve some number of defaults past crossing the horizon so that it gets squeezed enough. But eventually it gets to this regime where it's acting like a clock, clocking the long wavelength background. And all of this is encoded in the three-point functions that are generated by this interaction. So usually with inflation, we talk about correlation functions of just the field, but this is encoded in correlation functions with the conjugate momentum as well. So I have a correlation between the short wavelength conjugate momentum and the long wavelength fluctuation, basically.
This might be a naive question, but how is that consistent with the statement that the Heisenberg picture equation of motion for the mode is phi not equals zero after horizon crossing? I mean, I know that the power spike.
Well, phi dot isn't. I mean, the spread in phi dot goes to zero, but it's still some finite spread, and that corresponds to this spread in the conjugate momentum. So phi dot is small, but it's not exactly zero, and it's in that difference.
Okay.
And it's basically like the mode is freezing out, but it's becoming squeezed faster than it's freezing out, which is what makes the difference.
So turning on the interaction means that you evolve a Gaussian state in a non-Gaussian state. So the Wigner function of the full system will not be a quasi-probability, cannot be interpreted as a probability distribution anymore because it will be negative in some regions if you look at the global wave function, the global Wigner distribution. But I'm a little bit, so if I understand correctly, you do some approximation where you understand some of this evolution as just being a quadratic evolution within fixed regimes of momenta, but I didn't.
So the approximation here is basically that I only have an infinite wavelength fluctuation coupled to modes of finite wavelength. So I'm basically ignoring, and this is important as I'll explain, I'm ignoring the interaction between all modes except for really, really long modes and really short modes. And that approximation is what's going to sort of get me into trouble.
But you include interaction of short modes with short modes squared, like a triple interaction between short modes and so on, because that should already take you out of having a positive Wigner distribution or for fixed momentum.
Short modes with short modes squared?
Well, you have a triple interaction, no?
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure if the Wigner function is positive everywhere. I don't think it's essential to interpret the Wigner function as a probability distribution. What's important is that it has the property that its support in phase space gets entirely shifted when I turn on the Lyapunov fluctuation. So the fact that the modes are becoming squeezed excites the super horizon field into a superposition of classical configuration. So what I just described on the previous slide was the fact that it sort of prepares a sensitive measuring device. At the same time, it prepares the field in a superposition that can be measured. So I can view this squeezed state as being a superposition of these orange states, which are just like classical coherent states of the field. I'm preparing a field for measurements in one of these classical states in this way, and then at the same time I'm preparing it as a measuring device in the sense that it behaves like a clock. So the squeezing does both of those things. Just in passing, I should note that while I've been talking about an infinite wavelength fluctuation, I really want to talk about having some large or finite wavelength fluctuation in some finite size region. And so the natural degrees of freedom to use to talk about that are going to be some sort of localized Fourier modes. So what I want to be talking about is a mode of the field that's peaked around wave number k and then it's confined to some finite region around some point. And I can do this by just involving Fourier mode to field in real space. So it's these sort of localized Fourier modes that I want to talk about. So the records that I've been talking about don't have the property that it's information that's distributed spatially. And this can be understood in the following picture. So if I just consider some very long wavelength fluctuation in the field, and then I consider this spatial region and this spatial region, the respective short wavelength modes in these two different regions, according to what I told you so far, are going to be squeezed where the amount of squeezing depends on the long wavelength field. So these modes are squeezed a little bit differently than these modes because of the difference in the long wavelength field. However, there are no redundant records in real space. So all of these records are in different Fourier modes and they're just kind of on top of each other in real space. So this is essentially because once the modes cross the horizon, they're able to gain information about the long wavelength background. Because they freeze out after crossing the horizon, they're not able to take that information anywhere else in space. So it's sort of just stuck in some particular region in space. So if I want to use redundancy in different spatial subsystems to talk about branches of the wave function, then that's not what's happening here. And related to this is also the fact, which is related to what Lucas brought up, that I've been talking about coupling between really short and really long wavelength modes, but in reality, all of the modes of the field are coupled. So these short wavelength modes in this box here are going to be entangled with each other. And essentially, this has the effect of introducing a noise so that if I look at the reduced phase space for one of these modes, it no longer has this sensitivity. It's not sensitive only to the long wavelength mode, because it's entangled with these other short wavelength modes. There's a noise that just washes out the signal of the measurement of the long wavelength mode. So I need to go beyond inflation in order to get records in local subsystems for these regions. And so that's why we introduced the decelerated epoch. So again, we're just going to have inflation, and then we're just going to tack on a radiation era after inflation. And here we just put in the scale factor by hand. We have the inflationary evolution with conformal time tau, and then we start with some new conformal time eta, where the scale factor during radiation is just proportional to eta. And what we'll see is that this generates redundant records in many different spatial regions. So it allows me to talk about branches of the wave function, or to generate branches of the wave function in that sense. Okay, so let's dive into this decelerating era. So what happens in phase space to a given mode during the decelerating era? This left half of the picture is inflation. Again, I have a co-moving wavelength of the field, and I have time during inflation. The mode is inside the horizon, and then it crosses the horizon, and it gets excited, again, from being a simple harmonic oscillator in the ground state to some highly excited squeeze state, continues to grow in the number of quanta in this state or in the amount of squeezing while it's outside the horizon. And then at some point during the decelerating era, it comes back inside the Hubble scale. And when this happens, it's no longer getting more squeezed, but what's happening in phase space is it starts to rotate. So this is the phase space picture for a single mode during the total evolution, inflation and deceleration. And basically what happens as a result of this is that the clocks that I talked about, short wavelength modes acting as a clock for the local background, start to propagate around in space. So if I consider some short wavelength mode, which is a Fourier mode with wave number k, except for it's been convolved in such a way that it's localized to some region, sigma. After time passes and its mode enters the horizon in the decelerating era, the quanta, the particles that are in this highly squeezed state, start to propagate in directions k and minus k. Because the field is entangled in such a way that the k and minus k modes of the field are excited together in an entangled two-mode squeeze state during inflation. So this the form of the squeeze state in the particle basis can be represented in this form, where it's a sum of particle number eigenstates where I simultaneously excite the k and minus k modes. What this means is that after inflation, when these modes come back inside the horizon, they propagate off in different directions, and the information, whatever information is in this mode, is going to be collectively stored in the entanglement between the parts that propagate to the left and the parts that propagate to the right. And again, just keep in mind this. This sort of entangled mode shared between the right and the left is in a highly squeezed state, and so it has the potential to have a lot of information in it. The other thing that happens during the decelerating era is that I'm able to sharpen the records that were very noisy during inflation, because the short modes were entangled not just with the long modes, but also with other short modes. And so this changes because the modes decay when they enter the horizon. So if I look at the power spectrum during inflation, I just have a scale invariant power spectrum. And that had basically resulted in, so because the power spectrum during inflation was scale invariant, I didn't have a scale that I could use to separate off the entanglements of the short modes with the long modes from the entanglement of short modes among themselves. But now, at a given time, I have the scale that is the scale of the horizon, and fluctuations that have entered the horizon have all decayed. And so what this means is that if I consider some short wavelength degree of freedom, which is in this entangled EPR kind of form that I just introduced, this mode is going to basically only be entangled with the long wavelength fluctuations that haven't entered the horizon. So naively, it would be acting as, it would be sensitive to other short wavelength modes, but I can sort of think of this decay as wiping out the interaction strength for its entanglement with modes that are shorter than the horizon scale. So these short modes that are inside the horizon, they only see the coarse grained field. They only respond to the horizon scale field. And the punchline then is that I do have precise records which form after inflation. So if I consider one of these entangled modes in the decelerating era, these modes propagate across the horizon scale, just eta, the conformal time, and they respond to a long wavelength fluctuation in such a way that, again, if I look at the state of this mode in phase space, if I was to change this long wavelength fluctuation from phi to phi plus delta phi, some different long wavelength background, I again completely alter the state in phase space. So now indeed I have a property that the short mode records the long wavelength background, so that if I look at the overlap between, if I look at the overlap between the state of the short mode conditioned on phi and the state of the short mode conditioned on phi plus delta phi, it's zero. So I was able to distinguish between those different backgrounds. And what I find is that as long as the fluctuations have spent enough time outside the horizon, so they've become squeezed enough during and after inflation, that the precision of this record is just related to the size of this short mode compared to the horizon. So after a long amount of time, I can just have very small short wavelength wavelets compared to the horizon size, and this will mean that they're able to collect extremely precise records. And again, as I mentioned earlier, all this is encoded in the three-point functions of the field. So the way that we we do this calculation is we evolve the global wave function, and then we look at its three-point functions and essentially read off the fact that it's behaving in this way. Okay. So the key property here is that there's spatial redundancy. There's the same long wavelength information in many different spatial regions. So if I consider some two-dimensional slice of space, there's some region here where the long wavelength field indicated in red again has some value, and this is some horizon-sized region. These short wavelength EPR pairs have propagated off across this region. And as long as I have enough short wavelength modes and they became squeezed enough during inflation, there are many of these pairs that are all propagating in the same direction in the same region. And so they're all going to have the same long wavelength information. And yet they're in different spatial regions. And that's the key. Or eventually they propagate and separate into different spatial regions. And that's the key ingredient. You can write down the long wavelength degree of freedom that these short wavelength modes record. And this depends mildly on the direction that they're propagating in, which is k hat. So modes that are propagating in this direction are going to be different than modes propagating in this direction. They'll record a different long wavelength fluctuation. But the important point is that there are a large number of these modes propagating in basically the same direction that all record essentially the same variable. And this whole process is homogeneous and isotropic and scaling variant in the sense that what happens at one scale happens also to larger scales at a later time when those other scales enter the horizon. So this whole process doesn't depend on any particular direction or any special point in space. I have branching of the wave function in the sense of redundant records happening in all regions and in all as modes propagating in all directions. Just to take it back to the beginning of this talk, I can kind of think about these records in the same sense of classicality as records of a macroscopic object. So I have many different records of this rock in the electromagnetic field, and similarly, again, I have many different records of the long wavelength field in so sort of visible to the short wavelength field, parts of the field. So this was the sort of schematic picture of the state that I showed earlier, where it starts in this product state of different wavelength fluctuations of the field being unentangled, then fluctuations at different scales become entangled and acquire records of each other. And now I can see that, for example, if I look at this medium wavelength part of the field containing a record of the long wavelength field, the form that this record is in the amount of squeezing of these medium wavelength degrees of freedom. And as I said, the amount of squeezing is directly related to phases in the wave function. So a lot of squeezing corresponds to a rapidly oscillating phase. So these records are stored in the phase information in the wave function. Lastly, you could write down a condition for this branching of the wave function to happen. So I know that I need a non-zero interaction. And I also know that I need the modes to become squeezed enough during inflation that they're able to act as a sensitive measuring device. So what we find is basically, as long as this combination is very large, where A final to A initial is the amount of inflation, and hence how squeezed modes are able to become during inflation, as long as this combination is large, then there are some very long wavelength parts of the field which are redundantly recorded in the short wavelength modes. So I can think of this combination as being some measure of the sensitivity of the field as a measuring device. This clock sense. The last thing that I'm going to mention is that I sort of concealed this entire time that there are actually redundant records in the wave function, even in the absence of interactions. So this might seem surprising. And the reason that this happens is again, just a consequence of the fact that the field inflated and then the modes decayed and came back inside the horizon. So the power spectrum falls off as 1 over k squared once the modes, for modes that have entered the horizon. And basically, it's a consequence of this that the field becomes highly correlated in nearby regions inside a horizon patch, basically because I'm smoothing over fluctuations inside the horizon. So the field is highly correlated, and this leads to there being redundant records just in the sense that the field has the same value in many nearby patches inside the horizon. So the same variable is being recorded. So this raises the question, it seems a little easy to get all these redundant records without any interactions. All of the instances of measurements that are familiar to us intuitively, measurement in the lab or some classical macroscopic object, rely on interactions, we think, and are probably not just characterized by redundant information. We probably, as I mentioned earlier, want to have some notion of irreversibility of measurement when it occurs. So this raises the question of whether the records that are formed due to interactions can be viewed as having a certain irreversibility to them that these records in the absence of interactions don't have. So you can imagine that just these records in the free theory arise just because I play with the power spectrum and I modify the power spectrum on short scales. So that's not very hard to reverse. So maybe we can learn something in the future about irreversibility of branching of the wave function by comparing these different cases of the interacting case and the non-interacting case. And the last thing to mention is that in contrast to the interacting case, where the records were encoded in the amount of squeezing and therefore in the phase information in the wave function, here it's just a property of the classical distribution, the amplitude of the wave function, because it's just a property of the power spectrum. So that's a key difference that we'd like to understand better in the future. In summary, the QFT vacuum for a massless field in expanding space or with a particular time dependence in the Hamiltonian from expanding space acquires classical entanglement structure in the sense of having redundant records in many different regions of space, and equivalently the wave function branches into classical fields. So this is, we can basically view this as being a model that we can now work with to better understand how branching can happen. And the key ingredients here were accelerated expansion prepares a delicate superposition. So again, the squeeze state is the superposition of classical coherent states. At the same time, interactions allow modes that are very squeezed to act as measuring devices. So the squeeze state is also a clock that's able to measure longer wavelength variation. And then in the decelerating era, the information that's formed through the entanglements of modes during inflation is able to disperse spatially into many different local subsystems, and hence branching of the wave function. Briefly, I'll just list a few open questions that we are interested in looking into in the future. So first of all, there's this issue of irreversibility and conditions that we might require in addition to just redundant records in order to define branches of the wave function. There's the question of gauge invariance and Lorentz invariance. So we think that it's the case that because the entanglement structure that's formed is a long-range entanglement between many different local subsystems, that if I just do a change of gauge in such a way that I just redefine the degrees of freedom in each local subsystem, I should still have the same structure, unless I did a completely non-local gauge transformation. But we'd like to look into this more, and we also want to look into what happens, for example, when you do a boost to the coordinates and look at branches in the boosted frame. Time dependence of records and branches. We would like to ask, what happens to records of a particular long wavelength variable as time passes and that information sort of moves around spatially? How does the how do those records evolve in time? And also, what's the late time behavior of the wave function? So one thing I didn't really get into is the fact that at extremely late times, the interactions generate a large amount of basically non-Gaussianity in the wave function. So we'd like to understand that regime better. Also, we'd like a self-consistent model with gravitational back reaction included, in the sense that in this case, I just put in a scale factor by hand, and I didn't think about how is this field back reacting on the scale factor. But it would be nice to have a more self-consistent model. For example, a scalar field cosmology where the inflaton goes down potential and decays, and I fix the scale factor through those dynamics. So maybe we can talk about classicality during beheating. The closest real-world system that this corresponds to is most likely primordial gravitational waves. So we'd like to look into that a little bit more. Again, we fixed the scale factor to just be some classical function. But we could also look into quantum cosmology, where the scale factor is quantum degree of freedom, and look at redundant spatial records of the scale factor. There's a production of entropy associated with branching of the wave function. So given some set of branches, I can define an entropy associated with that distribution of branches. So we could look into generation of cosmological entropy in that context. Eternal inflation. So eternal inflation is in a non-perturbative regime where I no longer have a flat background FRW spacetime. But it would be interesting to ask if we can make any statements about classicality in eternal inflation or in patches of spacetime that stop inflating after eternal inflation. That's a little bit ambitious, but just thought I'd list it. And it might be possible to state some generalizations for nearly Gaussian wave functions. So the records in this case were just basically a property of the two-point and three-point functions of the wave function. So it probably wouldn't be that hard to write down some generalized conditions on leading order deviations from Gaussianity that are associated with branches and formation of records of classical fields. Okay, so that's it. Thanks for listening.
Questions for Riley? So you've talked about records and you talked about coupling to the scale factor in the sense of coupling to the geometry, but you have records in my mind are creating localized structure, and so now we're looking at breaking the symmetry, so your space-time, real space-time, is no longer homogeneous and isolated, but it has structure. And so as you...
Well, what do you mean the records are breaking
structure? Well, a record is something that's localized in space-time.
Yeah.
Or in space, persisting
in
time. And so if you have a localized information, localized structure, there should be that should be represented in the local geometry. So you should be breaking the symmetry of your geometry.
Yeah, I mean, it's represented in the local geometry in the, I guess, the trivial sense that it's just a spatially flat space-time, and it's in some region of that. I mean,
that's
field.
If you go back a few slides, you talked about the row of x.
This guy.
No, too far. You've gone too far. Just the last item you talked about, basically. Back to. Oops, it's at the bottom. It's not. It's at the bottom. It's right at the bottom there.
Sorry. That's your own.
All right. So you're
the probability distribution,
but this is now you're looking at localization of your information.
I'm looking at local
spatial localization of the information. So this is
I'm not sure how this is In what sense is this the what you're saying? What exactly is the statement about the probability distribution?
Well, is this not giving you, if you've got records, you say records are captured in row 5, what do you mean by a record if you don't mean something that's got some spatial localization?
Yeah, it has some spatial localization. And in this context, it's basically localized to this sort of wavelet of some size, which I call the sigma. But yeah.
Which exists somewhere in your space.
Yeah. Yeah.
That localization, which I'm saying, should be reflected in the geometry through the Einstein equations.
I could probably talk about it in that way, but none of this depends on matter affecting the geometry.
Well, I know it doesn't, and I guess that's what I'm looking for in the sense that I look at this process of leading to measure the structure formation, you should see it reflected, the information in the record should be reflected in the geometry.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we can go and talk about her offline. That sounds interesting.
I have another naive question, which is that so normally in cosmology we just forget about quantum mechanics after the horizon cross.
Yeah.
You make do a quantum mechanical calculation of, say, the power spectrum, but then just do naive use of classical Gaussian statistics for calculating everything.
Right.
Is that ever wrong?
No, that's not wrong. And those Gaussian statistics are just the statistics that I... that I get out of the classical distribution, which is the amplitude of the wave function. So I'm just basically discussing properties of the phase information in addition to that classical distribution. But no, none of that is wrong.
Okay.